make my life exciting. Bam, see you stand by me, always supporting. I'm Gary Field, just drive a truck. I'm Gary Field, just drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care, cause I just love your company.
Hello and welcome to Art and Labor. We have a new studio.
You may have noticed.
We sound fine instead of bad. We are a podcast dedicated to the ongoing struggle to survive as an art and/or cultural worker. I am OK Fox,
and I'm Lucia Love.
And thank you, Joey, for giving us your studio. You gonna say something on? Nope.
Thank you, Joey. Joey is sticking his tongue out at us.
No.
Joey says no.
I think so. We just had some food. It's nice. We're in a little space instead of sharing a field recorder next to a fan or whatever we normally do.
Yeah, we're like surrounded by equipment of all sorts and it's quiet. There's like egg curtain stuff on the walls. Moving on up.
Yeah, no, it's been great. I've been extremely online. Oh, one thing I meant to pull up was our new drip donors.
Oh, yeah.
We've been thanking our drip donors. Folks might have missed being thanked the first time because we did a bunch before our Sorry to Bother You episode. So people might have skipped that out of spoilers. But if you just listen to the first like 10 minutes, that's us thanking you for supporting us on drip. So I'm going to pull up our new drip people. We have several. It's great. And thank you so much for supporting us because we would like to keep doing this podcast without fear of losing our gigs and bullshit work. And just do this. That'd be great.
I've been extremely at work this past week. So hitting that reality of being like, wow, it's hard to find time to do anything but this.
Yep. So I want to thank Emily Reed for subscribing at the Gossip tier. Thank you for being our new boss. I want to thank my friend Charlie for subscribing as a true doodle bitch. Charlie, you are a true doodle bitch. Thank you for your talk about Jackass.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. Dude, I think about Jackass all the time now.
Yeah, dude, it's great. Our friend Sarah Crow, who is an amazing artist, comics, risograph, all sorts of things, painter.
And comrade.
Sculptor, comrade, comrade in our Marxist group, subscribed at the Gossip tier. Thank you, Sarah.
Dude.
Do we get any more?
Wait, did you get Sophia?
No, oh my God. Sophia Foster Demono subscribed and is now a true doodle bitch. And Sophia is one of the best working cartoonists like in the world. I feel very starstruck.
Well, shout out. Thank you.
It's incredible. Sophia did the cover of this anthology that I co-edited called Comics for Choice. So look that up.
That's awesome.
Sophia's work is awesome and people probably already know.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. You guys have 18 days left to become a founding member of our drip. We'll cement you forever. We're just going to keep doing this show in perpetuity and you want to get in on this on the ground floor because it's just going to grow. It's a good topic and it's resonates with a lot of people and I'm confident in its ability to grow an audience. So get in now. You have 18 days left. Also keep an ear out for like some sort of, you know, t-shirt and zine launch event that we're trying to figure out.
Oh yeah. people, there's going to be an art and labor party.
There's going to be a party. There's going to be
We're
going to release the manifestos, the first manifestos and maybe have a t-shirt ready, but definitely stickers.
Oh yeah, definitely we're going to have a t-shirt ready.
I don't see why not.
Yeah.
It's going to rule. It's really good design. We haven't unveiled it yet.
Yeah. Oh, It's going to be brutal. Oh, it's going to be so sick.
Yeah, it's going to roll.
I can't wait to wear this t-shirt.
I don't know if we want to say it.
Mm-mm, no, no.
Okay.
No, not yet. It's too exciting.
Okay, so find us on d.rip/art dash and dash labor to help us out, donate in whatever tier you're comfortable with. This episode, we're getting into arts, culture, the CIA, the FBI.
Paranoia.
Suck. The shadow people.
Yeah, they're all real. Turns out.
The water is making the freaking frogs gay.
Mm-hmm. And it's costing taxpayer money.
We're going to ride down to business. Well, there's some very real things to say about this topic. We're going to have, you know, our pal Hito Strial.
Oh, yeah. Continue on the block.
Be our guiding light through a couple of different disparate ideas we want to mention within this hour. Hopefully we don't go over an hour. If we do, we'll have to split it into two parts. So the Hito essay that we're going through this time is called Politics of Art, Contemporary Art, and the Transition to Post-Democracy. This was really early. This was December 2010. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the Hito stuff we've been reading have been like slightly more recent.
But she always seems to kind of be evolving the same message, which is that these alternative economies are like subject to capitalism at large, and that there's a lot more like brand takeover than there is genuine expression, and everything is dissolving.
So we're going to be a little critical of democracy this episode.
Because we never have been before.
We totally have been.
I don't know if they know how we feel yet.
The thing is, like, the idea of democracy is I feel like isn't inherently bad. What I like is social democracy. I like direct democracy. Mm-hmm. What we don't want is liberal democracy or, imperial democracy. Mm-hmm. And the democracy that we have right now in the United States is not a democracy, right? Think about it.
It utilizes a vote that has been, like, pretty much agreed not to do anything.
We got this useless electoral system. We've got, you know, all of these ways that people are disenfranchised. We've got, you know, really archaic ways of structuring primaries, and
we've got a lot of really clear issues that are being paid lip service.
Right. And that's, you know, that's in service of the status quo, and status quo isn't working, we'd argue. I think a lot of people would argue. I think the majority
Most people
would argue. I think everybody except for the ruling class would argue.
Yeah.
That it's not working.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Funny thing about that, there's more of us than them. Just saying.
Hey, and we're covering the planet.
Okay, so that out of the way. Hito says, a standard way of relating politics to art assumes that art represents political issues in one way or another, but there is much more interesting perspective, the politics of the field of art as a place of work. Simply look at what it does, not what it shows.
Yeah. I think immediately that statement encapsulates the way that I like to look at the art world, and just seeing, like, whenever somebody says, oh, this isn't interesting, or I can't get into art, there's so many other issues that we've covered, like, you know, it's so relatable when you look at it as a labor issue whatever
absolutely
is going on.
I mean, and even if I feel like the hardest people to win over about this are the artists themselves.
Sure.
But a lot of the times when you talk, the artists that are easy, that are easy to win over are the artists that have other jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Where you can be like,
they know it's not working for them. It's exhausting. Right, it's completely exhausting to be working 2 and 3 and 4 jobs, living off dreams. We've said this over and over again.
Right. Like, and you know, and oftentimes artists don't equate themselves with the workers who are like, you know, working in the galleries that maybe represent them,
mm-hmm.
institutions, the guards, all these other folks.
Yeah.
Like,
there's an ideological rift and possibly has to do with the identity factor of like embodying an artist's persona. Just saying like, oh no, of course I'm supposed to be like the nonconformist one who comes in with like crazy colored clothing. And I'm just like, well, I'm wacky and everyone else is like trying to organize me. And like, you know, maybe they have like, maybe they have a similar income bracket, but they're the ones who are like managing. I can't relate to that.
Can't relate. If you're, you know, if you feel like you're more of a manager, Mark says you have to pick a side.
Mm-hmm.
So either you're with us or you're with the ruling class. And again, there's more of us than them, so you want to be on our side.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Unless they give you a helicopter.
Then hey, you got a lot to think you. About. Can't fault you for that.
Yeah. Just try never to land.
Okay, so we cannot dissociate the hype around contemporary art from the shock policies used to defibrillate slowing economies. Such hype embodies the effective dimension of global economies tied to Ponzi schemes, credit addiction, and bygone bull markets. Contemporary art is a brand name without a brand, ready to be slapped onto almost anything, a quick facelift, touting the new creative imperative for places in need of an extreme makeover. The suspense of gambling combined with the stern pleasures of upper-class boarding school education, a licensed playground for world confused and collapsed by dizzying deregulation. If contemporary art is the answer, the question is, how can capitalism be made more beautiful? So, Hito is arguing here that art is often used as propaganda for capitalism. So
we decided to get into a few examples in real life around us all the time.
Right.
How that works. I mean, just off the bat, though, it's become so blatantly obvious, like, when you see all of these, like, you know, it's like Louis Vuitton and what's her name?
No, I just can't remember. Kusama.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was disgusting.
Kusama. It was absurd.
That was, that made me really mad even before I completely understood Marx. I considered myself like an anti-capitalist punk.
Right.
And I had respected Kusama's work as being this very, like, emotional and feminine art that somehow proliferated the mainstream.
Yeah. And it was such a, she was such a rare figure also to be dealing with femininity, but to be dealing with like issues of obsession.
Yes.
And then how that can be
her
linked
mental
to
obsessions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like, it is a little weird that she checked herself into the hospital.
Yeah.
And she just has decided to live like, I don't know.
But that's what we mean by it's very fucked up that like there's this Louis Vuitton crossover.
Yeah. Like her whole story is completely obfuscated now, and mm-hmm. to the point where like she has that installation down in the Rockaways, and most people, like, I was in a car full of people who were like, oh, yeah, yeah, there's some artist bitch, and she, like, put a thing in an abandoned house.
She's
and,
one
like,
of the most important
and
artists
she's, like,
in
bullshit.
History.
I don't know. It's kind of boring. Like, oh just, God. Like, dots and stuff. I don't get it. Like, what's the handbags about?
Oh, no.
And, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I think, like, Louis Vuitton had a hand in is totally, like, derailing yeah. this concept. And then also her shows being now about, like, mirrors and flashing lights.
Self-reflection.
Yeah.
Meditation.
But
like, it's very othering
yeah.
and very weird.
But beautiful. Shiny,
and she, I mean,
well-crafted.
I guess in recent years she said some weird racist stuff too. But I mean, like yeah. she's really really old.
She lives
and
in an insane
has
asylum.
A lot of issues. I don't. But also, yeah, that show was also sponsored by banks and stuff. And it's like that's antithetical to her work.
Oh yeah, but then that's just been going on.
Yeah,
like blessed Deutsche Bank is like the ruling patron of most museums that you
oh,
will
yeah.
see.
Yeah, and it's going to cause another global financial collapse.
It's going to be so cool.
Because they have a bunch of money tied up in these fucking paintings that nobody's going to be able to afford in, like, probably 20 years even.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean,
no,
less,
no. It's
less.
A speculative market, but it's actually, it's a hot commodity.
Forever.
The art market is great. You're actually making money
by
making art.
Actually, you are a valuable part of this business community.
Mm-hmm. Just don't break the ranks.
Oh my God. You'll get your crumbs, we promise.
Oh,
yep. Speaking of crumbs, he just says stop laughing, everyone. Speaking of crumbs, he goes on to say, contemporary art feeds on the crumbs of a massive and widespread redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich, conducted by means of an ongoing class struggle from above.
Hmm.
It lends, I don't know how much of this I should read, post-conceptual razzmatazz. it lends primordial accumulation a whiff of post-conceptual razzmatazz. Additionally, its reach has grown much more decentralized. Important hubs of art are no longer only located in the Western metropolis. Today, deconstructivist contemporary art museums pop up in self-respecting autocracy. A country with human rights violations? Question mark. Bring on the Gary Gallery.
Hell yeah.
And
where's the latest Guggenheim Museum? Is it like Guggenheim Dubai or whatever?
The next paragraph. The global Guggenheim is a cultural refinery for a set of post-democratic oligarchies, as are the countless international biennials tasked with upgrading and re-educating the surplus population. Class war from above and radical shock and awe policies.
Yeah, who's going to the Art Basel Hong Kong?
Yeah, dude.
This year? Do you need an advisor?
Contemporary art not only reflects but actively intervenes in the transition towards a new post-Cold War world order. It pollutes, gentrifies, and ravishes. It seduces and consumes, then suddenly walks off, breaking your heart. What does Hito mean by that, you might ask? A new post-war, a post-Cold War world order. What Hito means is that the Cold War has never really ended.
And that it was cultural.
And that there is a part of the Cold War that was cultural. And that part,
the majority of it was cultural. All of yeah. it was in messaging. And
yes.
it took place in more countries than just Russia and the United States.
Absolutely.
Everyone was participating. Like China, the Cultural Revolution, and Mrs. Mao just going, hey, we're all going to watch one movie. Just like how here we only have one movie.
Yeah.
And it's sorry to bother you. There, they only had one movie, but it was like, I love China. Mao is good.
Yeah, and we play that same game, and everyone, you know, wants to say, oh, we're better than China because we have free internet and whatever. That's never really been true, and is becoming less and less true all the time. Something that we wanted to get into this episode is there is a list of movies that have been given backing by the United States government.
Oh,
that's
wow.
been going around that I put on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, look this stuff up. We're gonna put it in the show notes. Like it's not that far fetched.
Well, it's become more common knowledge that any movie you watch that has a tank in it or has some kind of a plane or a gun is all being borrowed by the military. I mean, lent by the military.
I mean, Comrade Boots Riley retweeted this. So he says, here's a list. Find a bunch of war movies that the Department of Defense helped develop, but also find super movies and apolitical movies, too. It's, you know, it can be the influence. It can come from anywhere. So, like, here's a tweet that's a list of 410 movies that were made under the direct influence and supervision of the Department of Defense. And you got, like, you know, all sorts of things on here. Like, do you want to read some random ones? I've been reading them.
Oh, my God. I'm like, please don't let it be Babe in the Big City. Come on.
Come on. No whammies. No CIA influence. Please. Of my favorite films. Please.
Trying to find of course, like Air Force One and like a movie called America. Apollo 13, Armageddon. Like these ones.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Wasn't like Ernest Saves Christmas on there? There's some weird ones.
Yeah, that's what I'm. Battle Taxi.
There's more pages of these.
Yeah. Oh, Day the Earth Stood Still.
Aww. I mean, every Marvel movie gets a pass from like the CIA and gun manufacturers. This is just true. This is just how these movies operate. They've been told, they've been pressured by the government to let them have a pass, and they let them have a pass.
Oh, like, no, Ernest Saves Christmas. That is on there. Fuck. Oh, God. I don't know what to believe anymore.
I remember Marvel had this like event with like a gun manufacturer that it was like Marvel and Raytheon, or I don't remember what it was. And it was like, we're having a party. And then everyone's like, what the fuck? And then they're like, we canceled the party.
Oh, dude, Ferris Bueller? Ferris Bueller was one of them.
That's pretty nuts.
Father Goose, too. I don't know. Y'all, you gotta just check this out. I mean, a lot of these movies, they just look like propaganda, but that Ernest one, that hits below the belt.
Yeah, it's just weird to think about this stuff. And, Jackson Pollock, like, de Kooning, Motherwell.
Yeah, this is all famous knowledge. I was watching some of that, the Frances Stoner Saunders readings. She did a 4-part documentary series called Hidden Hands. The first part details how the CIA influenced culture through modern art and through literature and through music. But it is pretty hard to find online. So on YouTube, they have her talking. It's just about how she turned the documentary into a book. So she does this reading about how this guy, Michael Jolson, got commissioned by the CIA to set up the Congress for Cultural Freedom in 1950. So this was like, this was a core group that then would shuffle taxpayers' money to various shell companies. And the joke was that if it said freedom or private, it was probably the CIA because there were so many.
Oh my God.
And there, yeah. I mean, it had a list as long as how many movies are funded by the government, was how many like fake companies they had to say, like, sponsoring the arts.
Right. The other one that I wanted to mention was the Fairfield Foundation and the University of Iowa. Yeah. And the University of Iowa, like, they developed like the like modern MFA creative writing program that has since been like, you know, emulated throughout the country and the world. Like,
yeah. If you get that like Western literature anthology,
yeah,
they helped compile the way that we formulate our linguistics.
Yeah, the piece that I had been reading through is the How Iowa Flattened Literature. With CIA help, writers were enlisted to battle both communism and egg-headed abstraction. The Damage to Writing Lingers by Eric Bennett from 2014. So I'm definitely going to drop that in the show notes, but like some key parts of it is like these weird shell companies, the Fairfield Foundation and the Congress for Cultural Freedom, that like were directly started as a form of like university indoctrination into like anti-communism, basically. The people involved in the university would recruit left-leaning intellectuals, not just from more like cultural hubs in the United States, but also in Asia and Europe, just and bring them to landlocked Iowa to, you know, keep an eye on them.
Yeah, totally. and that was, it was like, oh, so maybe we're going to get these people in as philanthropists that just have a small company like producing petroleum or something, and then we'll give them some money to give to these artists and pretend like, you didn't get this from the CIA.
It was even,
promise you won't tell.
It was even like more blatant eventually. Like it was, you know, the Rockefeller Foundation. It was Asia Foundation, the State Department directly.
Mm-hmm.
They had like relationships to different publicity outlets, Time, Life, and Look magazines, which were like the only magazines that had the like capability of producing photography widely and distributing it. Like they did great things, like, you know, publish photos of the coffins coming back from Vietnam. Like that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
But like they also were being funneled this like propaganda from Iowa as like a way to like reify in people's minds, like, oh, this is where like, you know, our American culture comes from. Mm-hmm. This is it.
And it was also I mean at that point the 70s mm-hmm. people were starting to become aware that the CIA was functioning in this way, but the whole program, this whole branch was created in like 1947. So
yes.
At the time that people were producing modernist works of literature, if they were producing jazz, you know, nobody really knew what this branch of government did or was. It like Central Intelligence sounds creepy, and they were also like in competition with the FBI to influence various like propaganda maneuvers. Like
they all had their own ideas about how to influence culture. I mean, like even during World War II, like art, like art played a huge role, you know, in deciding, like, oh, this is what the Nazis like, this is what we like. Like, right. It's always, like, been a part of, like, how art is talked about. Like,
yeah,
this is the
enemy.
Yeah,
you gotta put up that good front. You gotta show, let your flag fly when you're looking at a painting.
Patriotism.
Like. I have this quote from Nelson Rockefeller about why abstract expressionism was, like, the embodiment of the American spirit. He thought it was free enterprise painting. And, like, free enterprise is what we want to push.
And yeah, rugged individualism.
It's
the
rugged
American dream.
Individualism, but enterprise also is, like, pretty explicitly commercial.
Yes.
So it's like free commerce, free market painting.
Entrepreneurial
Let's
spirit.
Also make these artists into the first ones to break, like, overwhelming fame in their lifetime.
Right. There was a clear push to make, like, Pollock and shit look like James Dean. Like, you know, they really wanted to get that picture in people's minds. And we were thinking about how witting or unwitting people like Pollock might have been during this process.
Yeah, the stuff that I was reading describes this, like, long leash philosophy that the CIA was campaigning with that was, like, kind of, here's why we have the Congress for Cultural Freedom, is because we don't want these artists to think that they are not really having the effect on their own. Like, because also a lot of the press surrounding this movement was like, dear Lord, I don't know what I'm looking at. This is garbage to my senses.
Yeah. I mean, I remember a story about Pollock learning techniques from the Mexican muralists. Like, I think it was Siqueiros or somebody taught him how to do, like, spray painting, sort of. Like, with, like, weird aerosol things or something. Like,
sure.
Let
me teach you how they do it on the streets.
Like, something, basically, and him just, like, kind of taking that and running with it.
Yeah, it makes sense because all of these artists that ended up being lifted through these programs did have participation in communist organizations.
Like, what I'm trying to say is Pollock seemed like he was friends to communists and stood up for them at times. But it's also, he's like a fucking wife beater shithead and fuck him. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. But it's so cool. Do you remember that time when Tom Wolfe was, like, writing about how he pissed in a fireplace? It was awesome.
Cool. It's just like how he pissed his paintings.
Mm-hmm.
His piss.
Wow. And it's cool. It's like, and he had this thing about cum. It was like he couldn't, like, do it or something, or he did it all the time or something. Why do I know this? Why is this history?
Why doesn't it? It shouldn't be. There's a much richer art history to be found in places other than America.
Yeah. And, or also just the fact that there's a robot arm shoved up his ass making him talk.
Making him a little puppet. He's a little puppet guy. Don't listen.
That's pretty interesting. Wow.
I don't know. I mean, the MoMA and shit did all it can to, like, compare the Mexican muralists, who by all accounts were, like, fucking incredible and
I like them,
had great manifestos and all sorts of shit,
and they never got all wrapped up in, like, weird fascist ideas, you know. I have a real bone to pick with the whole futurist movement, because if you just type in, like, Italian futurism and then you see that the futurist manifesto was written by the same guy who made the fascist manifesto, that one is a clear one. But Russians also took that manifesto and then just started adopting it and adopting the same style. Like, they just started using it from the Italians. And but everyone is like, no, but this is cool. Because they like, you know, then they started talking about other stuff. And it's like, well, why? I mean, there's other movements, though, too. It's just, it doesn't have to own your mind.
And man. This is why Stalin is bad.
Stalin is bad. He's a bad dude. Found out a little bit about his childhood, though, so now I know why.
Oh, what's that?
He was brutally beaten throughout his childhood
to the point where,
yeah, and his whole, like, left arm was like, somehow, it got all broken, and then, like, it wouldn't reset, so for the rest of his life, his whole, like, left side was all janky.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then he was a bank robber.
Oh.
Which is pretty dope,
well, that's great.
Actually.
That's great.
I'm pretty into that.
He should have just stayed a bank robber.
I know. Come on. But and he had this whole like bone to pick because he was Georgian, which is like not specifically Russian. So he had this whole like personal glory march going into the heartland and saying like, you know, I'm from your occupied territory, but I will occupy you all. I have so much rage.
Yeah.
And then he would go to jail and he would get like abused in jail. And it was to the point where there's some kind of a gauntlet thing that they would go through. But he would just be reading a book going through this like,
oh my God,
hazing thing. Just like, I'm that hard. That's the mythology of Stalin.
You can't break me. Yeah. You can't break me.
Yeah. I love it. He's like a fucking super villain.
Yes. God.
Oh, no.
Okay, so why and for whom is contemporary art so attractive? Hmm. One guess, the production of art presents a mirror image of post-democratic forms of hyper-capitalism that looks set to become the dominant political post-Cold War paradigm. So what does she mean by that? Post-democratic government is very much related to this erratic type of male genius artist behavior. It's opaque, corrupt, and completely unaccountable. Both models operate within male bonding structures that are democratic as your local mafia chapter. Rule of law, why don't we just leave it to taste? Checks and balances, good governance, bad curating. You see why the contemporary oligarch loves contemporary art. It's just what works for him.
Mm-hmm.
You can fit it in any old bullshit.
Yeah, and it also fits the structure of like, oh, well, how did those artists become historical figures? Because they were all related in some way to the people who were in governance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's almost like it's a big ass quid pro quo circle jerk or something.
Yeah. Or it's kind of like family business. Family business gallery, familybusiness.com, family business 21st Street between 10th and 11th. Hi, I'm the assistant director of Family Business Gallery, and it almost is like a joke.
It's almost like it's why it's called that.
Hmm.
Sick.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to know it and make a joke about it. Carry on.
Just carry.
It's fun. Hey, it's a good show.
It's almost like irony is the only weapon we have because we're too afraid of inflicting violence on each other.
Yeah, well, yeah, everybody has thin wrists.
We're just a couple of pansies. Don't make us fight.
Really, I'll go down easy.
Oh my God. She goes on to say, because all art also means work more precisely. Oh, wait, okay. So wait, before we get into that, sorry. I guess we should just read this whole thing. Traditional art production may also be a role model for the nouveau riche created by privatization, expropriation, and speculation, but the actual production of art is simultaneously a workshop for many of the nouveau poor, trying their luck as JPEG virtuosos and conceptual imposters, as gallerinas and overdrive content providers. Hey, that's me and you, the regular folks.
Hey, have
that's
a little
us.
Content about providing content.
Because art also means work, more precisely, strike work. It is produced as spectacle on post-Fordist all-you-can-work conveyor belts. Strike or shock work is effective labor at insane speeds, enthusiastic, hyperactive, and deeply compromised.
Yeah, I think this is kind of, this just makes me think of like linking back into the Susan Boyle piece, mm-hmm. and just like these themes are cycling.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, yeah. She calls it like this accelerated form of artistic production that creates punch and glitz, sensation and impact. She calls it its historical origin as format for Stalinist model brigades brings additional edge to the paradigm of hyper-productivity. Strike workers churn out feelings, perception, and distinction in all possible sizes and variation, intensity or evacuation, sublime or crap, ready-made or ready-made reality. Strike work supplies consumers with all they never knew they wanted.
And is it, I think it's worth it here to mention that the Stalinist model is like, I'm going to promote two or three artists at a time. I'm going to make sure that they depict the state in a very positive light, mm-hmm. and I'm going to kill them. When I think that they have too much autonomy, and then I'm going to take the photographs of them, erase them from the photographs, and pretend that I just take a lot of boat rides by myself. Rest in peace, the lost cosmonaut.
Yeah, but it, you know, here it plays itself. You know, Hito says it sustains itself on the time and energy of unpaid interns and self-exploiting actors on pretty much every level and in almost every function. Free labor and rampant exploitation are the invisible dark matter that keeps the culture sector going. So instead of like having to worry about like a couple of like really talented people having too much autonomy, you just throw everybody at everything all at once, mm-hmm. so that nobody gets a real hold of power on their labor force.
Yeah, too many players. Everyone believes that they're all going to have their own slice of the pie, and they mm-hmm. start competing amongst themselves.
Yep.
Stick them in a grid system and they can't even remember there are stars in the sky.
Buddy, I got news for you. If you are selling your labor, you are a worker.
Mm-hmm. Workers of the world unite. Hey, do you get a paycheck? I get a paycheck.
Even if you are selling your labor for free.
Mm-hmm. Hey, if you're not getting money, that's even more of a reason to just, you know, come hang out. Come here.
Shit, that sounds really bad. Yeah, that's the art world, buddy. Mm-hmm. Contemporary arts workforce consists largely of people who, despite working constantly, do not correspond to any traditional image of labor. They stubbornly resist settling into an entity recognizable enough to be identified as a class. Phew. Mm-hmm. Phew. Yeah. You know, think about here the...
We're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah, we're doing it to ourselves, but I think about, there's this quote... You know, artists can fit into any class and are therefore the most dangerous.
Oh, right.
Not anymore, buddy.
Yeah, really.
The most pitiful class there is.
Oof, they've really figured out by our shoes. They're filthy, for the most part.
I mean, like, I feel like that could still be true. We just gotta, like, you know, take it back, demand certain things. Mm-hmm. One method I would suggest for harm reduction under capitalism would be to fight for free schools.
Oh yeah,
that free could be schools. A good start.
And how's net neutrality going? How about that? How about just like because okay, we're not teachers, but we're definitely in a school right now, and we're collecting a lot
Buddy,
of materials.
Buddy, podcasts are school.
This is like, you know,
call everyone buddy today.
Hey, pal. Hey, Hey, chief, this is a school.
Everyone's my buddy.
I'm learning some things from the internet. I don't want it to go away.
Yeah, this is just, that's all, we're developing a thesis.
Yeah.
What we're fucking doing.
I don't really know if I want to do it, though, in some fucking house of propaganda.
No, sorry, not me.
No way. I'm doing it in a sound booth.
Can't buy us?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, you can. You just gotta find us on Kickstarter.com. Mm-hmm. Drip. The worst, owned by Amazon, the worst shit. Whatever.
Give us a little drip. Just drizzle a little bit of money into our bank accounts.
Fuck, why is it called drip? I don't get it.
It's nasty.
Yeah, so we have to face up to the fact that there is no automatically available road to resistance and organization for artistic labor. That opportunism and competition are not a deviation of this form of labor, but inherent to a structure that this workforce is not ever going to march in unison, except perhaps while dancing to a viral Lady Gaga imitation video. The international is over. Now let's get on with the global. So, this is, you know, Hito in 2010. This is like, I don't know if I agree entirely that, I don't know if, I mean, I agree that the way things are right now, like I said, harm reduction things, housing, schools, if we can get a couple of those things together, perhaps we could reorganize the art as a labor force.
Yeah. It's complicated to, because any direction you push always ends you up against the wall of like, well, what's really necessary?
So, I mean, we're almost at the end of Hito. This is like the last paragraph. Or no, it's not, but it's good.
We're rounding.
This is all good. Just gonna read the whole fucking thing.
Whoa, damn.
Here is the bad news. Political art routinely shies away from discussing all of these matters. Addressing.
It's not true. It does address, like, everyone is addressing it.
This is 2010 again.
Sure.
Like, this is like kind of pre even Hito Strael.
Yeah, so, she's writing before herself.
She has tried to figure out a way to infiltrate these things, and I think she's been kind of successful in her later stuff. But it's not all bad.
I'm going to tell you a story about an artist that makes this claim incorrect.
Yes.
I can do it later or now.
I mean, I don't know. I guess I'll finish this. What she's her thought here.
Yeah.
Addressing the intrinsic conditions of the art field as well as blatant corruption within it. That's what Hito does. That's mm-hmm. what her art does now. Think of bribes to get this or that on large scale biennial. She's achieved that post writing this. Is taboo even on the agenda of most artists who consider themselves political, even though political art. Man, she was so nihilistic, but she did all this. She did all this. Even though political art manages to represent. Oh, shit. My thing went away.
Oh, represents so-called local situations from all over the globe and routinely packages injustice and destitution. The conditions of its own production and display remain pretty much unexplored. One could even say that the politics of art are the blind spot of much contemporary political art. Of course, institutional critique has traditionally been interested in similar issues, but today we need a quite extensive expansion of it, because in contrast to the age of an institutional criticism which focused on art institutions or even the sphere of representation at large, art production, consumption, distribution, marketing, etc., takes on a different and extended role within post-democratic globalization.
Yeah, and she says one example, which is quite absurd, but also a common phenomenon, what we talked about before, is the is that radical art nowadays is often sponsored by the most predatory banks and arm traders, completely embedded in the rhetorics of city marketing, branding, and social engineering. So for very obvious reasons, this condition is rarely explored within political art, which is in many cases content to offer exotic self-ethnification, pithy gestures, and militant nostalgia.
Yeah.
So if you see that in art, not great. Not revolutionary art. Sorry.
Yeah. If you catch it, run.
Yeah. I mean, but it's nuts because, you know, she's developed a practice since this that does try to address these things.
Yeah, and I think that there is like also a lot of like good-natured disciples of Hans Hacke, mm-hmm, that attempt to make sculptures and statements about the market that they exist in or the political structure, and they just don't get shows.
No.
that's what I feel like. That I don't know, there's always that fine line that people seem to draw in Sharpie and completely miss the part where all of these people exist who are talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, she talks about, you know, art field as a place of power mongering, speculation. She says that a lot. Financial engineering, the examples we talked about before, massive and crooked manipulation, populated by mobile shock workers, salesmen, tech whiz kids,
mm-hmm,
budget tricksters, supersonic translators, PhD interns, and other digital variants and day laborers. So again, when we talk about art, we have to talk about all of these different types of art workers.
Right.
It's all in the same field.
And they're all against each other for one philosophical reason or another, for the most part. I mean, it's really nice when you meet somebody who can get down with a painting show and a movie and a poetry reading and, you know, then go home and carve a log with a chainsaw.
Right. Yeah. It's
a rare person.
Art and culture are one and the same, and we just got to find a way to bridge all these disparate cultures. She says, like, people with charming scumbags, bully kings, almost beauty queens, it's HDMI, CMYK, LGBT, pretentious, flirtatious, mesmerizing. kept afloat by the sheer dynamism of loads and loads of hardworking women.
Yeah.
She's like a serious feminist kick in her earlier writings for sure. A hive of effective labor under close scrutiny and controlled by capital, woven tightly into its multiple contradictions. This is the last paragraph. All of this makes relevant to contemporary reality, art affects this reality precisely because it is entangled into all of its aspects. It is messy, embedded, troubled, irresistible. We could try to understand its space as a political one instead of trying to represent a politics that is always happening elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Art is not outside politics, but politics resides within its production, its distribution, and its reception. If we take this on, we might surpass the plane of a politics of representation and embark on a politics that is there in front of our eyes, ready to embrace.
Hmm.
And then she went and did just that, folks.
Yeah.
She's an inspiration.
So cool.
Some of my favorite work,
is
her video pieces, and this 2010 piece can be read as like an artist statement, but she's not an artist. She doesn't consider herself an artist.
Oh, she's definitely organizing her platform here, and it's interesting to note her consistency. Always finding the same issue.
I love it.
Yeah.
Do we have any final thoughts? I mean, there's
I've got to tell you the story that I've been dying to tell you.
Fuck, sorry. I've just been reading the whole essay out loud.
Yeah, you just... I
just wanted to get to it because
stuff.
Like I really what I really like about that essay is that she offers a solution. She offers another way of thinking. What I don't like is criticism that doesn't offer any alternative except for like weird like minor reforms or tweaks to the current status quo or whatever.
Oh, definitely.
I like solutions.
I love solutions too. I'm still waiting for solutions, but I love the way that people communicate. And that is that's excellent. Communication is key. Pinpointing an issue is key. I want to know what to do. I'm still communicating that I'm here and I'm ready to do something. But until I hear something that makes sense to do, I'm just going to keep learning.
Yes. Learning's cool, folks. Do it on your own terms.
Keep learning.
The library is the best thing that is fucking government has to offer us. Go to the library.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to tell you about something that relates to all of this government influenced art and politics in creation. This is my favorite painter, I think. His name is Werner Tubke.
Okay.
He is from the Leipzig School of Painting. He's from East Germany. And he's like operating in, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s. So he's experiencing like the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, is part of like communist occupied Germany.
Yes.
So he's making these paintings that are like insanely, insanely detailed, which goes against propaganda dictates of how you're supposed to construct an image. Basically, everyone wants something easily defined, easily read, easily understood. And his response to that is to like take these styles from the 15 and 1600s, mash them all together, and then make like he made this thing that's in the Panorama Museum in Bad Frankenhaus is the name of the place. It's German. Bad Frankenhaus Panorama Museum. You'll see that he ended up creating this 360 painting that's like it's like 120 meters. Mm-hmm. It's insanely big.
Wild.
It's like the history of the German Peasants' War, which is this uprising.
Yes.
Yeah.
That rules.
It's the whole fucking German Peasants' War in 360, and he just sat there like Sistine Chapel style and painted the whole fuck out of it.
Dude, I mean, yeah, that's why I like the fucking Mexican muralists too. Like Orozco, Siqueiros, and Rivera, like they just spent all their fucking time depicting these labor uprisings. Mm-hmm. And like,
and they get all these people get slept on. It's
totally
insane.
Slept on. It's wild.
So Tubke has some quotes about working in a place where the government openly affects the art that is able to be produced.
Mm-hmm.
So he says that so he's not restrained from showing his work in West Germany, even though he has like these like strong scenes of like these figures that are like flying a hammer and sickle, and they're like slamming into people who are like waving Nazi flags, and mm-hmm. people are like gutting each other, and it's pretty realistic. I'm dropping books and freaking out. Like, you guys, I love this painter. You have to see this stuff. So he says there's total freedom to paint whatever one wishes, and that means abstraction or anything else. And it's just strange. If there are any artists who leave East Germany, if one counts them, there are very few. That is their own personal problem and has nothing to do with freedom of expression as a visual artist. So people are being given some monetary support to continue making this stuff. And he says that he is one of 20 artists that are, quote unquote, privileged. And basically the government gives them homes, cars, they're allowed to travel for shows. Like, this is a system set up. They're on the dole. Okay.
Reminds me of, like, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, if you have seen that.
Oh, yeah. They also have this school system that's set up where basically it's like you go to school to be an artist, and then you get entered into the artist's union.
Oh.
So they have like a government optioned thing where once you're in the artist union after going through this system, you can shop at the art supply stores, and it's only like your union membership card gives you the possibility to shop outside of hobby shops. So if you're just like an artist on your own, you don't have access to these materials. So it's a little bit like the way that it's set up in China, where from an early age, children are like tested to see if they have any like gifted, I don't know, draftsmanship or something. And then all of a sudden they get funneled into this like weird state function kind of realist style of production.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's weird. That's like
very, yeah.
Yeah. Looking at these government systems where artists are being taken care of in some respects and then also being like extremely kind of turned into bonsai trees in other respects.
Yeah. It's not like this is like an open identity for everybody to take on. It's not democratic. It's interesting. But yeah, I would say like it would be neat to get to a place where everybody can participate in artistic expression.
Yeah, definitely. But at this point, it's more just like it's like different in relationship to something like the NEA.
Oh yeah.
So we in America are like, oh, I'm not sure, you know, is this Andre Serrano okay? Like the Piss Christ is pretty offensive. I'm not sure if the government's allowed to give money for that. And Werner
Tubke,
look at
fucking Giuliani breathing down your neck, like,
yeah, just like, hey, you can't put dung on a painting of a Mary. That's terrible. And in contrast, like this guy is saying, you know, here I'm allowed to like make a picture of like, hey, here's a painting of destroying the government. Here's a painting of rising up against the elites. And here's what that looks like. Here's us slicing the heads off of as many of the aristocracy as we can get a hold of. And here's a bunch of people being slaughtered in response. And
yeah, but it's just like, why only him? Like, what weird ass fucking phrenology formula are they doing to determine like, oh, you're the one?
Well, if you look at his paintings, though, like, they're fucking, I don't know how he's fucking incredible. You guys, he's fucking incredible. He's amazing. He says the whole system is set up to control everybody. It doesn't need extra pressure to control who is an artist and who is not. But
yeah, that's really interesting. I'd say some of my favorite artists make memes.
That's chill.
And they're constantly getting pushed around by demonetization shit, similar to our previous episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember there's a huge purge of all the meme artists from Facebook after like getting a big profile about them in the Washington Post. That's and then suddenly they're all like swept away, like they're trash and none of their shit matters.
Yeah.
To anybody, but it does matter to a lot of people.
How can you prove that you even made that meme? I mean, everybody has that meme.
No, yeah, these are, and I'm talking about people who do make all the memes themselves. I'm talking about like Gangster Popeye and like, I don't know, all the fucking weird ones back in the day that I can't remember. But Gangster Popeye's still around. Corin the Abyss rules is still around, and these are people who are like who are artists. A lot of them have got like go to art school. The one we posted on our Twitter recently, was it Social Practice Mafia?
Oh yeah,
they rule. They're new, and they're really good.
Yeah, I'm intimidated. Like they know what's going on with the art world.
Yeah, come on Art and Labor. We want to talk to you.
Yeah, come say hello.
We like you.
You are very funny people.
And I like cartoonists. And I like that as a form of like anybody pick up a ding dang pencil and draw something. I don't know. Make a zine. Well, that's more like why I like to make a zine. I know there's like very rigorous, whatever tradition of cartooning that I don't mean to like brush aside. But I like the idea of zines. I like the idea of anybody can make a zine.
Oh, yeah. I think there's no hierarchy of culture, but there is something to be said for the people who put an impressive amount of labor
and giving
their
them
endeavors
and like giving them a space to do that.
And just saying, like, I think we can find room in the revolution for incredible large-scale works that lift the human spirit and make people feel like their struggle is valid. Something that they can get excited by.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, as long as they're also like serving the kitchen every now and then, you know, doing all the other, taking out the trash.
Well, hey, everybody,
jobs too.
Yo, y'all gotta wash your ass. Okay. Yeah. Wash your ass and then you can make some cool art.
Pitch in.
Feed people.
You know, give other people a chance to give it a try if they want to give it a try.
Be cool.
Yeah, that's what I'd say. I'd say that's good for this episode, and maybe we'll do our next episode will be more about like surveillance.
Yeah. Ooh.
And we'll just continue this thread because there's tons of Hito stuff about surveillance.
Oh gosh,
we haven't really even touched.
Yeah, and I'm reading that new book, Surveillance Cinema.
Oh, cool. And what's the book you got in your hands there, buddy?
And this book that I'm holding, like a little Christian icon or something. I don't know. I'm like praying with it right now. It's called The Strategic Reality Dictionary, Deep Info Politics and Cultural Intelligence. I got this book when I was in an undergrad in like 2010. And it blew my mind open. It was like, oh my God, wow, they're talking about tulpas in here.
Oh my God, tulpas, shit, dude, that's a whole other episode.
Oh yeah, right?
Oh my God.
Yeah. There's so much
there
to
shadows
get into.
In the wall.
Yes, and they can become real.
They can become real.
Oh, your thoughts make reality, and it's like all crystallizing and stuff. You're in the Matrix, and you could just like make.
Here's my impression of Alex Jones finding out that he was demonetized from Apple, Facebook, and YouTube all at once today. No, no, no. That's my impression.
Wow. I saw him. Oh, two. We're getting a note from the studio.
It's the end of the episode.
All apologies to everyone's ears if they just went through that. Alex Jones is an angry guy.
No.
Yeah, you're just gonna have to sell your powders now. So this Strategic Reality Dictionary is amazing. It's by this group of artists who their whole aim. Okay, I'll just read this. The Strategic Reality Dictionary offers 72 keys to the construction, imposition, and maintenance of contemporary systems of inclusion and exclusion, which only function for two principal reasons: because of stealth, and because they are able to engineer our own unconscious beliefs. Implicit throughout this book and clearly stated at critical junctures is the notion that autonomous cultural agents can devise counter systems that act to reveal, question, and disrupt the fictional communities that continue to bind us in unwanted unions some 400 years after the time of Giordano Bruno.
Oh, shit. Dude, see, we should have read this at the top, or we'll continue. I think let's continue this thread to the next episode.
I would love to get into this book a little bit. Share some stuff. But everybody at home, check it out. Strategic Reality Dictionary is dope.
There's definitely parts that, you know, relate to that, like, post-Cold War continuation of art propaganda and shit that is relevant to what we talked about this episode. But there's also a tie to this episode and the surveillance state.
Yeah. That... I think we should just stick on this for a little because it's huge.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's a lot of information. Yeah. And it makes you feel like Alex Jones. And it's fucking... it's a little...
Yep. People! Squabblings!
But it's all true. I mean, just you can look it up yourselves. There's multiple sources. There's lots of ways you can find this, like... I mean, I'll post it on the show notes, but it's like, it's just a fact. Everyone knows this.
Mm-hmm.
Ask any art historian about this.
Mm-hmm.
Ask any regular historian about this. Ask anybody who studies the history of the FBI and the CIA.
Yep.
It's
easy access to the secrets at this point because all their stuff is done. But who knows what they're doing now?
Who knows?
Who knows? They could be having more secrets.
You know, abolish the CIA, abolish the FBI, abolish ICE, abolish the police, abolish the NHS.
But there's just so many programs we don't need.
Abolish the military.
Yeah. Well,
that's a big one.
You know, that one's a. I'm scared.
Replace it with our own Red Army.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's cool. That's cool. I'm like, we need something. I don't know.
Anyway. That's us. Have fun with it.
Oh, yeah. Let's have fun.
I get if you have an aeroplane that can fly the world and we can have a fantasy. It doesn't really matter if you drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive for galaxy. I really don't care if you just drive a truck. I get if you just drive a limousine. It doesn't really matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care because I just love your company. Let's have fun. 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 Lots of fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Lots of fun. Let's have fun.